calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, it's getting stranger and stranger out there, my friends. Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. The Reverend Ted Haggard has emerged from 3 weeks of intense counseling, convinced he is completely heterosexual. Yep, the guy's totally straight. No gay there at all. Ted Haggard, he's cured. That's the official word. Meanwhile, in the state of Washington, and this is so cool, and yes, we're going to talk about the budget, and yes, we're going to talk about the war, and yes, we've got Russ Feingold, Joe Lieberman, and there's just a million other things, too, that we're going to get to as well, and your calls. And in the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking, debating with Larry Pratt, Gun Owners of America, about the Brady Bill and its reauthorization and whatnot. And in our third hour, Michael Pettit, he's going to be from EveryChildMatters.org about red state children at greater risk than blue state. But here in the first hour, this is just incredible. At the same time that Mr. Haggard comes out with his, I'm cured, we have up in Washington State, the state Supreme Court came up with this weird theory that the reason why a law basically saying that it's legal for the state to discriminate against people based on their sexual preference, in other words, people can have rights of visitation and rights of inheritance if they happen to be opposite gender, but not if they happen to be the same gender, what is often referred to as marriage, although in Vermont they refer to it as a civil union, that right is because the state has an abiding interest in procreation. This quote, the Washington State Supreme Court said, quote, the state has, quote, a legitimate interest in preserving marriage for procreation, end quote. So a group of activists in Washington State have put together a ballot initiative. It's called Initiative 957. Very straightforward. It's just great. It says, marriages in the following cases are prohibited. When the parties are unable to have children together for any reason. All couples married in this state shall have 3 years from the date of solemnization of the marriage, or 18 months from the effective date of this act, whichever is later, to have filed with the state registrar of vital statistics or designated deputy registrar at least one certificate of marital procreation. You have to prove you had a baby within 3 years. When the state registrar of vital statistics determines that a marriage solemnized in the state has failed to produce offspring, as described in Section 5 of this Act, he or she shall file a petition in the Superior Court of the county wherein the marriage license was filed, requesting that the marriage be annulled on the grounds of failure to fulfill the purpose of marriage. Hey, if it's all about having kids, people who don't have kids, they're not married anymore. Yeah. And they're actually, you know, folks are out there getting signatures, and I think it's just great. I think it's just great. The Washington Defense of Marriage Alliance, Washington DOMA, no, that's no accident. DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, was the piece of legislation that Bill Clinton signed that kind of started this whole bandwagon of the right-wingers going, oh, no, we can't allow gays to get married. Holy cow, can't. Anyhow, so they just took the acronym, but they changed it from ACT to Alliance. The Defense of Marriage Alliance in Washington State, by parodying the state Supreme Court ruling last year, hopefully they'll wake some folks up. I mean, that would be a fine thing. It would be just an absolute fine thing. In fact, I'd say it would be an important thing. George W. Bush submitted his budget yesterday, and it's taken a little bit of time to digest this thing, but there are some things that are quite clear about it. The main one is that it illustrates brilliantly the divide between conservative thinking and liberal thinking in America. I mean this quite seriously. And not in any kind of, you know, Bush-bashing sense or whatever. George Bush is doing what is consistent, and the Republicans who are supporting him with this budget, and the people in the administration, and the many Republicans who will vote for it, or conservatives who will vote for it, there are conservative Democrats, I'm sure, as well, are absolutely consistent with their worldview that the value and power of America, the quality of life in America, is determined by the power of its wealthiest people and its wealthiest institutions. And that we are not all in this together, that America is not a nation of barn builders, but is rather a nation of Daniel Boones. That we are all independent entrepreneurs, that we're all striking out on our own, that we all should have a chance to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. And if you don't have any bootstraps, well, tough luck. That's the breaks. And so, that, you know, the conservative worldview. On the other hand, then, you've got the liberal worldview that says, yes, we agree that people should have opportunity. We agree that people should have the opportunity to become wealthy in America. We agree that people should have the opportunity to find fulfillment in America. We agree that people should have the opportunity to accomplish the things that they want to accomplish in America. And we believe that there should be a certain minimum threshold below which we will not allow any of our fellow citizens to fall. And we believe that it is the purpose of our society, one of the jobs of government, is to help enable people to accomplish those great things, to become entrepreneurs, to become educated, to become physicians, to become lawyers, to become whatever they want, to become car mechanics, to become whatever they want. We think that the role of government is to help enable that. And that's why we have public education that is free in the United States. And why it should be extended all the way through the PhD level or to technical schools. And that's why we want to make sure that there is a minimum living wage paid to people. This would be the liberal worldview, right? It was a good thing when Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years. The programs of the 1960s, providing for the children of families living in total poverty and facing the challenges of not just generations, but centuries of discrimination in the United States. Families like Condoleezza Rice's family and Colin Powell's family, allowing them in one generation, using public tools like public education and affirmative action programs in that generation to move into the middle class. That a middle class is a good thing. And so you look at the budget that Bush is putting forward, and you know, I think at a certain level we have to probably cut George W. Bush a little bit of slack. This is a guy who was born with a multimillion-dollar trust fund, who has never succeeded at anything in his life. He ran for Congress, he lost. He's in three different businesses he was involved with. Two of them failed. The third one he got in and he got out on his daddy's friends. He was in the military. He went AWOL and then he deserted for a year. And yet he was never held to account for any of those failures. Alcoholic, busted for using cocaine, you know, did his 30 days of community service, wrote it up in his autobiography, like all of a sudden he had 30 days of sudden altruism in his life. But you have to get it that he probably really has no idea what it is like to be part of the working class of America. And I would submit to you that that's probably true of at least two-thirds of the multimillionaires in the United States Senate. And it's probably true of many of the Republican millionaires in the House of Representatives. That they have simply never known what it is like. They have never woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning and stared at the ceiling thinking that, you know, if they lose this job, that they're 2 months away from being thrown out of their house. That if they lose their health insurance, that pre-existing condition will never get covered again, and if they get sick one more time, they're going to get wiped out. That they've simply never had to deal with those realities that most Americans have to deal with. Because what we see here is that in Bush's budget, his 2008 budget, he's proposing $77 billion in cuts to Medicare and Medicaid over the next 5 years, $280 billion in cuts over the next 10 years, a $233 million cut in funding of the Children's Health Insurance Program. $4.9 billion cut. That's an 8% cut in programs to train people for employment and provide social service grants. $100 million cut for Head Starts, for the Head Start program. This is a program that helps people in poor neighborhoods, disadvantaged families. helps their children move, you know, educationally into the middle class. A $2.4 billion cut in community and regional development grants. $400 million, 18% cut in low-income home energy assistance program. $172 million cut, a 25% cut in funding for housing for low-income seniors. Well, these guys just, they never have any contact with the real America. And so, of course, they would, but at the same time, he wants to make sure that anybody who makes over $1 million a year gets an average $162,000 a year tax cut. 16 minutes past the hour.
Winding up somewhere, one step ahead or behind. It ain't been so easy, but I guess I shouldn't complain. I've always been crazy, it's kept me from going insane.
All right, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and slightly unbalanced, but who wants fair and balanced after all? Hospitals would lose $30 billion in 5 years. Medicare cuts to be painful. This is the headline in the conservative Wall Street Journal today. Hospitals would bear the brunt of President Bush's proposal to cut Medicare spending by $65.6 billion over 5 years. See, again, this comes back to this fundamental difference in worldview between conservatives and liberals. Between the idea that the conservative idea that there is a that society should have classes and orders, that there that an aristocracy is the natural state of things, that an oligarchy, a small number of very wealthy families or corporations, as the case may be, ruling a nation, is how human society should be organized. That as Alexander Hamilton said before the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and there has never been a greater form of government organized by man than that of Great Britain. His suggestion was that the president should be elected for life, that we should have a king here as well. However, rather than have a lineage that is hereditary, when the guy dies, you elect a new king instead of it being, you know, DNA. That's the conservative worldview. That the old Calvinist idea that wealth is an exhibition, a demonstration. Wealth is the proof of God's blessing. John Calvin's original notion that he brought to, as I recall, Switzerland and then England and Scotland and then the United States. So here we have, and therefore, the flip side of that obviously is if you're poor, God must be unhappy with you. If you're poor, you must have done something wrong. If you're poor, you must be morally defective. If you're poor, then, you know, why should the rest of us worry? Ignoring the fact that most of the people, that probably the vast majority of the people in the United States right now who have great wealth, probably the vast majority of the millionaires and billionaires in this country, at some point, two, three, four generations back in their families, were very poor when they came to this country. Well, that doesn't matter. Because they finally broke through. Well, it's a good thing to break through. It's a good thing to be successful. And the liberals among us, from George Washington forward, believe that there should, yes, this government was caring for the poor. In George Washington's budget, there was money to care for the poor, to provide food, shelter, and health care for the poor. In George Washington's budget, this has always been part of the American experience. Well, these guys were the children of the Enlightenment. But that's not the conservative worldview. The conservative worldview is, hey, if you've got money, you can pay for it to go to a hospital. If you don't have money, why should I care? That's their worldview. So as Jane Chang wrote in today's Wall Street Journal, the budget also called the hospitals would bear the brunt of President Bush's proposal to cut Medicare spending by $65.6 billion over 5 years. The budget also calls for the elimination of the practice of Medicare reimbursement such provider, reimbursing such providers when beneficiaries fail to pay their bills. In total, hospitals would see about $30 billion in Medicare payment cuts over the next 5 years. Now, here's the other part of the problem. You see, because most Americans are not conservative, and they don't share that conservative worldview that, oh, somebody's poor, to hell with them. Because most Americans hold traditional liberal American values, the values of the Enlightenment, the values that inspired and helped create this country. We're all in this together. In fact, even at the level of the world, we're all in this together. You know, if the Nazis are taking out Europe, we're going to take out the Nazis. Because the majority of Americans share that worldview. These guys know they can't sell this stuff without lying about it, and they rationalize their lies as being for the greater good. So George Bush is planning on borrowing, according to his budget that he just presented, on borrowing over $1 trillion from the Social Security Trust Fund between now and 2012, the year that he says he'll have a balanced budget, so that he can claim that by 2012 he'll have a balanced budget. But it won't be a balanced budget because it will still involve, it'll still require borrowing at least $200 billion a year from the Social Security Trust Fund. But because that money doesn't show up in the budget, it's another part of the budget, it's like money that falls out of the sky. Or at least he can pretend that way. So he essentially is lying to the American people. And it's a lie, by the way, that's being picked up by the New York Times, running a headline today, implying that Bush is going to balance the budget by 2012. No such thing is happening. He's going to borrow it from Social Security. But they believe that lie is justified because they know most Americans actually don't agree with their worldview. But they're so certain that it's right and good that a lie is justified in order to make sure that the conservative good is inflicted on the rest of us. 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, 27 minutes past the hour.
Play something country. Now play something country.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Just to put a fine point on this, before I start taking your calls here, I just want to bring this back around. Again, the conservative notion that the strength of a nation is measured by its wealthy people and its wealthy institutions. That's the conservative notion. If a nation has powerful, wealthy individuals and wealthy institutions, it is a great nation. The liberal worldview suggests that if a nation takes good care of its people, if people have the ability to achieve self-actualization, have the ability to live in peace, if life is good, if you can raise your children well, if there's a high level of social mobility, the ability to move from one social class into another social, upward without great difficulty, thus things like free public education, free health care, that if the least among us are protected, the liberal ideas put forward by, for example, that liberal Jesus, or I can never say it right, or many of the other historic, brilliant liberals. Okay, but the conservative worldview, because the institutions are what's more important, you even see this in the budget, in Bush's budget, when it comes to defense spending. Right below the story in today's Wall Street Journal headlined Medicare Cuts to Be Painful, on the exact same page, which would be page, I already cut the corner off, so I don't have the number. But anyhow, on the exact same page, right below that article, Medicare Cuts to Be Painful, which also notes the president's budget also includes a proposal to increase Medicare premiums for seniors. Right below that is another one that says defense spending, another headline, Greg Jaffe and Jonathan Karp, defense spending is set for sharp rise. President Bush is asking for almost $625 billion in defense spending in 2008, a big increase, but one that may not be enough to cover the rapidly increasing cost of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, additional personnel in the military's appetite for new weapons system. In a boon to defense contractors, weapons spending is set to rise even faster than the overall Pentagon budget. Now get this. This is corporations good. Right, this is the conservative worldview. If it benefits the wealthy and the powerful, it's good. The administration is requesting $101.7 billion for new weapons purchases, a $20 billion increase over 2007, just over last year. It's a 20% increase. Including research and development, total weapons spending is set to grow to $176.8 billion. And just about every major weapons system is set to get more funding than in the current fiscal year. But what about the human beings in the military? A little farther down in the article, Jaffe and Karp note, some defense analysts say the Pentagon hasn't set aside enough money to pay for the 92,000 soldiers and Marines President Bush plans to add. You see, it's not about the people in their worldview. It's not about the GIs coming home. It's not about the homeless vets on the corner as you drive down the street holding a sign saying, you know, homeless vet will work for food or whatever. It's not about them. It's about whether the defense contractors get another contract. You know, those guys that Don Rumsfeld was making his living as a lobbyist for when George W. Bush invited him to become the Secretary of Defense. They note the administration's budget would take weapons funding to the highest level since the 1980s buildup under Ronald Reagan. For what? So that we can drop nukes on people who don't want us in their country? Alex in New York City. Hey, Alex, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Hey Tom. Can you explain to us why the budget of the United States is a cash based? I heard Barnett from the budget committee saying it's not a normal kind of a budget the way
right.
a corporate. Can you explain that?
Sure. Corporations do accounting based on accrual, and the administration submits their budget on a cash basis. At least that's my understanding. And the difference is on a cash basis, you're looking at, you know, what's going to come in and what's going to go out this year, and then they're projecting on a cash basis out. On an accrual basis, you calculate all of I'm probably doing a lousy job of explaining this, but you calculate all of the expenses and you also include the assets and liabilities. Cash, you know, actually, Alex, I'm not certain exactly what the commentator that you're speaking to was referring to, but I know with a business, for example, that on accrual accounting, traditional accounting, you have to consider the value of the assets that you have and what you're doing to those. For example, what are we doing to our national parks? What are we doing to our school systems? These are part of the assets of the United States. And what kind of debt are we incurring? What are our future obligations with things like Social Security and Medicare, things like that? All of that would show up as great big bright red bells in an accrual accounting system. On the other hand, if you ignore all those things, if you ignore the assets and the liabilities, and you just look at the flow of cash through the system, then you have a cash accounting system. It's just expenses and income. And that's, my understanding is, that's the basis of the budget. And so that would probably be the point that person was making. But, we it might be a good idea to get an account, you know, get somebody like Ravi Batra on and ask him about it. So,
Anyhow,
thanks for raising the question. Gwyneth in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Gwyneth.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Tom, and
sure.
Thanks for your work. I wanted to comment on the budget, Medicare, Medicaid in particular.
Mm.
We talk about our country has the value of taking, well, the religions have the value of taking care of the least among us to caring for the poor. Well, often those people are the people who paved the roads, who built your house, who cleaned up after an accident and took you to the hospital, those people who haven't been living on enough money to be able to pay for health insurance, and so they end up getting hurt, and they are the ones who are being cut from these services.
Right, or they're the ones who didn't have a very, very large retirement nest egg, and so when they get to be 70 years old and they get sick, they get wiped out financially. And
they get wiped out. Physically as well. They are the ones who are being cut from Medicare and Medicaid, the ones who worked and worked and worked, the working poor, as if they have no value once they have stopped working. And even the ones who are born with a serious disability, my brother's son has severe developmental disability. And my father, who considers himself a liberal, says, I just don't see the value of this kid. He's just a burden to his parents. Mm. And I'm just appalled at the concept of his not understanding the value of caring for people who bring us other things besides money.
Right.
And what is really happening...
A sense of our own humanity.
That's right. And what is really happening in this country is the same thing that happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s, when they decided to stop paying for social services, and people who were sick or ill or had some sort of disability were pulled out of their homes, and then they were shot mercifully, I suppose. But now people are just being abandoned.
Yeah, not only that, Gwyneth, they actually had these mobile euthanization units that the Nazis came up with in the 30s as part of their eugenics program, which actually they copied on America's. We were the world leaders in eugenics, although we were not doing killing, we were doing sterilizations, particularly of Native Americans. And also of people who were mentally retarded, or people, a lot of minorities.
Right.
And what they had, what the Nazis did, is they built basically little U-Haul trailers that they would haul behind a truck, and they would pipe the exhaust from the truck into the trailer and put people in the trailer and kill them with carbon monoxide.
Wow.
And yeah,
what they're doing today is worse than that, because I work in the field of people with disabilities, and there have been, in Oregon alone, 10,000 people a year dying from the withdrawal of their health care, who would have survived and been functional people, and if the laws were different, many of them contributing people, if we had universal health care, could still be contributing in other ways. But now they're just being killed by, what is that, negligent homicide?
I think that you could call it that, and well said, Gwyneth. Thank you for the call. This is so brutal, essentially, what the Bush administration is trying to inflict on America. Dee in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Dee, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I was wanting to comment. I know you're from this area, and we had Dick DeVos, who ran for governor.
Yeah.
Thank God the residents of Michigan were able to tell him, no, you can't buy the office after all the money he spent.
Yes.
But also, the only time his family seems to donate for helping anybody around town is make sure their name gets on it. But when Dick DeVos is actually running for governor, he actually made the statement, well, if the poor want insurance, all they have to do is go get a job.
This is the guy who was shipping jobs off to China, right?
Yeah, right. And on top of that, I mean, his father goes to England to get a heart transplant. I don't begrudge the guy that. But, hey, I lived in England. There's no waiting list. If you got the money, you can get it.
Yeah.
And his father also just got back from going to England and, you know, having his annual heart checkup. 2 days. So it's like, you know, what are they thinking? I mean, you know, hey, I'm one of the, quote, working poor. I haven't had health insurance. Ask me what field I work in. The health field.
Yeah. Now,
so
that's the tragedy of it, Dee. You're absolutely right. And what they are thinking is that they are entitled to what they have because they believe that it's appropriate that there be an aristocracy in America and it be based on wealth. Dee, I got to run. Thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
And I'm taking my country back.
Oh, indeed, my friends.
I've been doing it right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes.
What'd they do? Tell us.
Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you botched Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
And welcome back to the radio support group on Fight for We the People. Tom Hartman here with you. Bernie Sanders and Ben Bernanke debating. We've got that clip we're going to get to today. We've got Ben Feingold. Senator Feingold on the floor of the United States Senate talking about how he's a little concerned about what's going on here. Mr. Lieberman and Mr. Warner debating patriotism. How did the vote break out, this vote on to shut down debate on the non-binding resolution? My resolution is better than your resolution. Yesterday,
We'll get into that as well as we go throughout the day. But it seems to me that, actually, I don't want to prioritize that. I want to say, you know, more important than the debate on the war is the budget, because really they're the same thing. This is all the war on America. This is all the conservative war on American values. This is the war. You're seeing the ongoing consequence of the war on Roosevelt's New Deal, you know?
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah, I know. Go back to your cave. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Kevin in Dallas, Texas on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Mr. Hartman, first time caller. I just wanted to tell you how much I respect your show.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yeah, thank you very much, Kevin.
And I just wanted to let you know that, you know, the imperialist fascists, they got it going on. They have America deceived until white America steps up to the plate to change it. Because all your movements in this country have come through the frustration and anger of white America. The minorities don't add up to change anything. So I just wish that you would concentrate on the point that white America needs to step up, change this, get these Nazi fools out of office, man.
Yeah,
and I appreciate the venue.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. I would respectfully submit that it's not just white America. It wasn't white America that was out there marching in Selma, you know, Martin Luther King. It's that transformed this country. But the point that we all need to get active and we all need to get out there. Yeah, good one. Jason in San Francisco, California. Hey, Jason.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
Well, I as I told your screener, I worked in Iraq for 2.5 years for KBR. I'm a progressive thinker, and I basically went over there to get some of my money back from the electric bills that we were having.
Okay.
I had a number of comments, really, primarily on what I saw while I was over there. The way that the military is set up and the way that they spend their money, and I got there in June of 2004, just as the 4th Infantry Division was leaving. And the 1st Infantry Division was coming in. And the 4th Infantry Division had this giant grand scheme on what they wanted to do with the facility that we were at. And we had this big plan, and this is how it was going to happen. And all these things were ordered, and all these things were brought in line. And then 1st ID comes in and totally changed everything. So here's all this spent money going to one place, and then somebody else comes in and basically changes everything, and we end up spending money on that. And there was a lot of things.
And in the middle of it all, Kellogg Brown and Root, a.k.a. Halliburton, well, actually the Halliburton division that was reincorporated in the Cayman Islands so they wouldn't have to pay U.S. income taxes on all the profits, KBR that you were working for is making out which both ways, right?
Well, yes and no, and the thing is they would insert little things here and there where, you know, Billy Joe Bob's good old boy brother-in-law has a toilet-making company back in wherever, you know, Arkansas or whoever, wherever, and they would order tons of this stuff, and it gets there, and we have no use for it, or it gets there 2 years later. We ordered trucks that we really desperately needed to do our job. We ordered those trucks, or my boss ordered them, in October of 2003, I believe. We did not get them until November of 2005. You know, and so the logistics of everything was a total joke. It's all going through somebody's friend or relative or anything back there.
Yeah, see, and, which brings us back to this conservative worldview that, you know, government, because government has no value. Because as Limbaugh says, Roosevelt is dead, and we're doing away with government, or you know, let's shrink it down to where we can drown in a bathtub. If government has no value, and you don't believe in governance, but you're in charge of government, and you got all these billions of dollars, but you think that being rich does have value, then what do? You get yourself rich, and you get your buddies rich.
Exactly. And you know, the money makes the world go round, and how do you want to go about making the world go round? Do you want to focus your energy into making the world a better place, or do you want to run around killing people and making weapons to do
that? Yeah, that's the bottom line. Jason, well said. Thank you very much for the call. Julie in Seattle. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Tom. I think it's interesting that we now have a conservative system that's so far in place that what we're rewarding is wealth rather than work and possession rather than production.
Yeah.
And a good example of that system, you mentioned the Medicare cuts this morning, and obviously one aspect of that is the reduction of eligibility. But I think equally important is the fact that this overall reduces the rate that Medicare will pay, the percentage they'll pay of what they're billed by doctors and hospitals.
Right, which means the private insurance companies move in and pick up the rest. So so we've got more Bill McGuire's with his $1.78 billion salary.
I had a conversation with my doctor that led me to do some research on this. He indicated to me after we saw some Medicare bills from my husband that, and I was shocked at how little Medicare paid on what we were billed.
Yeah.
He said the only people who pay full price are the people who are uninsured, that the insurance companies, set their rates of reimbursement based on what Medicare will pay, and certainly the difference is not going to go back to a reduction in premiums for people who are paying
No, of course not. If they can make a profit, they will. Julia, I'm out of time, but thank you very much for the call. And interesting point. Good point. Well made. Amazing. Coming up next, let's see, Larry Pratt, I believe. Larry Pratt with the Gun Owners of America. We'll continue this debate. 57 minutes past the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Mrs. McCarthy of New York, the congresswoman from New York, she says in testimony before Congress on March 8, 2002, Peter Troy purchased a .22-caliber semi-automatic rifle. His own mother had a restraining order against him as a result of his violent background. It was illegal for him to purchase a gun, but he simply fell through the cracks. 4 days later, he walked into Our Lady of Peace Church in Lynbrook, New York, opened fire, and killed two innocent people. Peter Troy had no business buying a gun, and the system created to prevent him from buying the gun failed. That is why I have introduced House Resolution 297. This is a piece of legislation that would provide money to states to update their databases so that they know for the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, NICS, N-I-C-S, so that they know if somebody trying to buy a gun is a criminal or not. And Larry Pratt with Gun Owners of America, gunowners.org. You got your panties all in a wad about this, Larry.
Well, we think that it ought to concern more than just gun owners. In addition to arguments that we have that it's not something that's going to have the intended effect, it's not going to keep criminals from getting guns. What it is going to do, and you've touched on it, is centralize data from the states that the Attorney General will be able to determine what is relevant. And it's the only word that's used in her bill, but relevant information in order to find everybody who should not be owning a gun. And that would include illegal aliens. And what is pretty clear that is in mind with this is to have state tax returns, health records, education records, basically a database that is scattered throughout the state's county courthouses.
No, hang on just a second. I have the legislation here, and this provides a national instant criminal background check. Oh, wait a minute.
That's right. It's going to expand on that.
But it has to be under subsections G or N of Section 922 of Title 18, which basically says that you have to be convicted of a crime in order to be in this database. We're not talking about your tax returns. We're talking about whether or not you were convicted of a crime.
Well, you would be committing a crime if you were an illegal alien and you had a gun, because that is a prohibited person.
Well, that's fine. I don't want illegal aliens running around with guns. I don't want any prohibited persons running around with guns. Do you?
Well, what you're going to face then is trolling through all of that relevant information. And the irony is that we're on the verge of killing, happily in my mind, the real ID measure, which sets up the national ID card through our driver's licenses. Enough states are likely to bash that this year that is probably going to collapse. And yet through the back door, we're going to be setting up the same kind of centralized data capability that would have been utilized by the national ID card.
But there's a very real distinction here. We're talking with Larry Pratt. He's the executive director of Gun Owners of America, gunowners.org. And that distinction is that, I'm with you on opposing the Real ID Act, because the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution and the basis of American jurisprudence is that if you're innocent, you are left alone by society. Government has no business sticking its nose in your life.
In fact, government has to prove that you're guilty, doesn't it?
That's right. Well, they have to prove that there's a reasonable, that there's a probable cause, that a reasonable person would believe that there's a probable cause that you're involved with a crime before they can even begin investigating you. Exactly. And so the Real ID Act, in my opinion, violates that, as do, in my opinion, things like, you know, random stops for, you know, checking insurance and checking, you know, all kinds of things like that. I think those are all violations of the law, frankly.
I think we have more in agreement than you might have thought on this.
But
actually, the instant background check operates on the same premise as the random stops.
I'm with you on that, but there is a distinction here, and the distinction with regard to this some would call it an expansion of the Brady Act. It's really the Lautenberg Amendment, I believe. But Carolyn McCarthy's House Resolution 297, which I'm guessing in all probability is going to pass. The distinction is that this deals with people who have already been convicted of crimes. Now,
not exclusively. It's people who have been indicted and people who would be breaking the law to have purchased a gun. Maybe they were habitual drug users, whether it be alcohol or something else, whether they were a veteran sent for a mental checkup after a battle when they had the shakes. These are the same kind of people as that illegal alien. There's a lot of people.
Now, that would only now hang on. You're distorting this here, Larry. It would only be the veteran who went in for the checkup for the shakes if somebody got a restraining order against him.
No, no. If you are sent to a mental institution, that's going to zap.
Oh, if you have been institutionalized as being potentially violent.
And so the veteran that gets sent for that chill out, if you will, he's going to.
So you think the people who have been institutionalized as being potentially violent should be allowed to buy guns?
Well, see, they're not institutionalized as potentially violent. A lot of people that are institutionalized aren't violent at all. There's a big difference between a criminal and somebody who's mentally off. And that, I think, is a distinction that needs to be made.
Well, I got to tell you, my best friend when I was 19 years old, this was during the Vietnam War. He got drafted. He went off to boot camp. He came back during Christmas. I saw him. We got together the next – Clark Stinson was his name. The next day, he went out. He bought a gun. He put it at the back of his mouth and blew the back of his head all over the wall. I have a real concern with, for example, you talk about people who have been institutionalized. You know, Clark had been struggling with depression his entire life. And his suicide was the crescendo of that. I think that there's something to be said for saying to somebody, I'm sorry, if you've been institutionalized, you know, you're not getting a gun.
Well, the criminal is one who has a predatory mind. He thinks other people are there.
But there are more people who commit suicide with guns in the United States every year, Larry, than there are people who stop crimes with guns.
Well, there are more people that commit suicide in Japan without guns than commit murder and suicide in the United States. So,
but that's apples and oranges, because it's illegal to own guns in Japan. There are no guns in Japan.
But the suicides are carried out all the same. So if somebody's going to do it, that's the way their mind was working. Happily, it was not at least something directed toward other people. But that's a different sort of person from the typical criminal who is truly a predator. One of them told a psychiatrist that had worked at St. Elizabeth's Mental Institution for years, "Doc, if they did away with the laws making rape illegal, I'd have to find some other way to break the law." That's the predatory mind that ought to be the subject of everybody's concern, and this broadening to all kinds of other people and to all other kinds of data. You know, I understand you're for gun control, but don't let that blind you to what's being done in McCarthy's bill.
Well, define gun control. I may or may not be in favor of gun control. I believe that there are certain minimum thresholds that should be established if you're going to carry a deadly weapon. As somebody who enjoys playing with deadly weapons, frankly, I go to Michigan. My brother Steve and I go down to the shooting range. And it's what we do for fun together. But that weapon that I'm holding is designed to destroy, is designed to create damage. I mean, you know, if we're going to, if to drive to the shooting range, I have to demonstrate competence to the state because I'm going out in the public roads. I have to demonstrate the competence in driving a vehicle because that's potentially a deadly weapon. Then certainly I think that I should demonstrate to somebody some kind of competence before I walk around loose with what is intended to be.
That all sounds good, but you know, England has gone the whole pig. You don't have to worry about instant background checks to buy a handgun or most other guns.
Well, we're not England, Larry.
You just can't buy them.
We're not England. You know, in your news release here,
finished on, and yet criminals end up getting guns there much more than they even had in the past. So you don't have to worry about this instant background check failing. We know that it's going to fail. The Centers for Disease Control did a study about 2-3 years ago and found that the gun control laws, including the instant background check, haven't worked. So we
haven't worked 100%. I mean, to extend your logic, that's like saying, well, you know, you're not going to ever stop every single terrorist who's coming to the United States, so let's just stop trying.
All I'm telling you is that the instant background check has had no impact on lowering crime, and in Britain all they got for their trouble was to become the most violent of the industrialized countries of the world, according to a UN study. So what we're talking
about... Their gun laws are completely different than ours.
Yes, they're very draconian. The pistol team for the Olympics has to go to Belgium to practice. That's how difficult it is to
right.
Get your hand
they're
on a handgun.
Right, they're completely different than this. This is just saying, let's check people out.
They have more violent crime with guns than we do. So, yeah, it's really different. You betcha it is, and I don't want to go down that path. And I think we should realize that they've gone much farther than the instant background check, and yet the instant background check is being touted as something that's going to keep criminals from getting guns. It doesn't. It just keeps them from getting
guns. It stops 700,000 people from getting guns since it was first
brought in. At a store with their own ID. But if they get a false ID or they go out on the black market, they got themselves a gun.
Yeah. So again, you can't stop terrorists, so why bother, right?
You're going to let Carolyn McCarthy set up the backdoor national database. Way to go.
Well, I hope that it doesn't come to that. Larry Pratt, gunowners.org is the website. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks,
good talking to you today.
Good talk.
16 minutes past the hour.
Jane's got a gun.
Uh-oh!
Big Jane has shot someone.
Uh-oh!
Cindy, she in bed run. Better watch her liberal buns. Tell him that the war's not through. They probably put a hole in you.
And welcome back. It's the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Harmon radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. You know what was amazing is when we were doing research for this segment, first of all, my take on gun control. I lived 10 years in Vermont where there are virtually no gun laws. You can go down, gun control laws. You can go down to the local gun shop, buy a gun, strap it on, walk around town. But it's a rural state. People go hunting there and, you know, whatnot. On the other hand, you know, I've lived and worked in New York City where I just can't figure out why anybody in New York City should be allowed to walk around with a shotgun. And, you know, so I think that this is something that, by and large, quote, gun control, in quotes, should be up to the people of local communities. I don't think that it should be a federal issue, broadly speaking. That said, I don't want people with criminal or violent backgrounds, I don't want people with restraining orders against them to be able to walk into a store and buy a gun. Yes, I know that they can walk into a gun show and buy a gun, and I think that that's a loophole that needs to be closed. So, anyhow. But the interesting thing was when we were doing the research for this segment, for this discussion with Larry, just plugging in this House resolution, H.R. 429, I think it is. No, 297, excuse me. You plug it into Google, and you get like 300 hits from, I say this affectionately, you know, like my, you know, my brother and his partner, you know, it's gun nut sites, you know, people who own guns and multiple guns like my brother does. And are really into guns, and nothing from the gun control fight, because there's like these organized lobbies, and there's all this money, and there's an industry, and there's all. So anyway, I think in Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore raised some issues that we as Americans need to be facing, specifically the violence in our society. Which leads us to a discussion of what's going on in Iraq and with this whole mess. First of all, First Lieutenant Aaron Watada on trial in Seattle. I interviewed him in June 16th of last year, and he made this comment to me on the air, which I thought was brilliant.
Basically, I come to the conclusion that that this war is illegal and unlawful, and therefore, in order to force me to participate in, or any soldier, or any member of the military for that matter, would be illegal as well. So I believe it's my duty and my obligation to the Constitution and this country to not participate in a crime or obey an unlawful order.
That'll be an unlawful order. And, you know, that Lieutenant Aaron Watada, in a conversation that we had back in June, and spot on. And his trial is ongoing. And in something like right out of Franz Kafka, if you've ever read The Prisoner by Kafka, I mean, you know, right out of Kafka, the judge says, well, the basis on which you are deciding that you will refuse deployment, the basis of your argument, is not something we're going to talk about in the courtroom. Say what? I thought state of mind was like, you know, a really important thing. So anyhow, you've got that going on, and then Senator Feingold out here calling for Americans to get involved. This is from Countdown, the Countdown program, Keith Olbermann's show yesterday with his guest host, whose name escapes me. I'm sorry, but here.
This requires public pressure. It requires people to let their elected officials know that not only do they want a debate, but they want action. They don't want just non-binding resolutions that say, hey, we don't want to have more troops. We want a resolution. We want legislation that says that here's a time frame during which this war needs to end. Let's say 6 months from the enactment of the bill, and that the Congress is going to cut off the funding for the war.
Bang! Just like that. I mean, you know, that's the Russ Feingold talking on MSNBC. Here he is on the floor of the Senate talking with Joe Lieberman. I'm sorry, this is not Feingold. This is Warner. Senator Warner, the Republican, talking with Lieberman, the independent. Lieberman sucking up to the Bush administration. Warner, who served in the Navy in World War II and in the Korean War, and was the Secretary of the Navy. Joe Lieberman, who never served in the military at all. Here's the dialogue.
I thank my friend. The difference, of course, is that ours is as non-binding as yours, but ours is a statement of support to our troops.
This is Lieberman's non-binding resolution to say, "Go get them, George."
And benchmarks to the Iraqis.
Madam President, I'm clearly, what I've read is correct.
This is Senator John Warner, the Republican.
But I assure you that I forcefully argue that ours is in support of the troops.
And this is the ours being, you know, get them out now.
And there's no suggestion that one is less patriotic than the other, if I may say to my...
Actually, not get them out now, but reconsider.
One is not less patriotic than the others, but actions have consequences. And as I said during my remarks, for the Senate to take this unprecedented action on a non-binding resolution to disavow, disapprove a mission that our troops are being asked to carry out right now cannot help their morale.
Oh, well. Poor Joe Lieberman, who just, you know, never served in the military, but he knows about the troops' morale. How about their morale about being shot at? How about their morale about being blown up in a war for which there is no good reason, there's no justification? A war, an illegal war, as Lieutenant Aaron Watada pointed out. There's a man of courage and conviction. 27 minutes past the hour. Take your calls right after this break.
Don't take your guns to town. He drank his first strong liquor, then to calm his shaking hand, and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down, and he heard again his mother's words. Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home.
And welcome back. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. And Jane in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Yes, sir. I attended the support to Aaron Watata yesterday in DuPont, Washington, at the south end, I believe, of Fort Lewis, Washington.
Great. By the way, is thankyoult.org still the best website to...
Excuse me, ask that again, please.
Is thankyoult.org still the best website to provide...
I believe it is, sir.
...support? Okay.
But the reason I called was another matter, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I met Helga Aguayo yesterday and this gentleman, Augustine Aguayo's two adolescent daughters and his mother. It is the first time that she has come out. This family is thousands of dollars in debt. Mr. Aguayo was deployed to Tikrit, Iraq, I believe in 04. He has been pursuing for over 3 years his conscientious objector status. He really needs help. The family is very much in debt. They live in Los Angeles. He is imprisoned in Mannheim.
He's
scheduled to go March. Hello?
Is this the fellow whose rank is sergeant? There's a sergeant who's been getting some publicity.
I do not know. He is in the 1st Infantry Division and was sent back when he went AWOL September 1st. Yeah. After pursuing all his legal options, they denied him habeas corpus and his status. If people want to help him and his family and other war resistors, they can go to couragetoresist.org/donate. And if you want to know more about the Aguayo case, look at aguayodefense.org. I referred his wife to you, sir, but I think she's too shy to call.
Okay.
And she was
you've done a good job of it, Jane. How do you spell Aguayo?
It's Aguayo, and there's hundreds of these people. Couragetoresist.org/donate.
Okay, great. Jane, thank you very much for the heads up.
You're very welcome, sir. I knew you'd promote this. Thank you.
Actually, you did, but I'm pleased to put you on the air. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. So, I just wanted to call in on the balance of gun ownership.
Sure.
In California, we actually have some laws. You can't go hunting without a 16-hour hunter safety course. You can't purchase a handgun without a month-long waiting, a 30-day waiting period.
Mm-hmm.
These are pretty sensible things. I think I wanted to point out, though, is that there's a tendency, particularly among urban people, to think that that owning guns is meaningless or even dangerous and that the guns themselves are evil. And yet, here I am, an urban dweller who takes his son out rabbit hunting in the San Joaquin on a regular basis and goes up to the mountain and does skeet shooting and so forth. So I think there's definitely a place for urban people who own guns and use them responsibly.
Yeah, I didn't say that somebody in New York shouldn't own a gun. I said they shouldn't walk around Manhattan with a shotgun in their hand.
I go along with that.
But yeah, point taken. And like I said, you know, my brother and I do target practice. You know, I'm a vegetarian, and in fact, I think Steve still is too. It's you know, we don't go hunting, but you know, we're boys and they're toys. I mean, there's just around that, you know. Yeah, so anyhow. Thank you very much, Steve. Good to hear from you. Rama in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rama.
Hey there, Tom. I just wanted to say, in terms of your guest who talked about gun control, I have to quote the words of the man with the plan. All those who pick up the sword shall die by the sword.
Yeah.
And we have to do this with peace.
Yeah, good point. We should be talking about peace. We should be promoting peace. And yes, if you pick up the sword with the intention of killing with the sword, then you die by the sword. I don't disagree. Charlie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Charlie, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a quick call. I wanted to know if you had seen the editorial by Krugman on the green zoning of America. It's really, really telling, and I think it's kind of fallen under the radar scope. But
no, I missed it. When was this?
February 5th, and it deals with the whole plan to outsource government, and directly talking about getting rid of civil servants, because when they get rid of them, they can give the money to the big benefiters of the Republican Party.
Oh, right. This was the day after. In fact, I was going to do that story. I had all set for a rant here on the program, and flat out ran out of time about how massive the privatization movement is in the United States. It was in the weekend New York Times, just last weekend.
Yeah, I've got a friend at EPA, and he says what they're doing to them is just unbelievable. And he's got basically 2 years left to try and wreck the country. I mean, they've
Bush
got,
does, yeah.
they've got the Supreme Court, and they're bankrupting the safety net, which were their two big goals. And so if he can, you know, if he can kill the civil service, then he's really met their goals. And this war is a great smokescreen for all of that. But basically, it just gets back to the whole plan is to give the contracts to the companies that give money to the Republican Party. It's got nothing to do with saving money for Americans. In fact,
no, it costs money. In fact, in the article in the New York Times, they were talking about how the agency, what is it, the GAO, the Government Accounting Office?
Correct.
The agency that oversees this was short on inspectors to look at waste and fraud, and so they hired a private contractor, and they were paying these guys $106 an hour to be looking at whether or not there was waste and fraud going on, right? I mean, it was outrageous, the opening story in this piece in the New York Times over the weekend. Yeah, absolutely right. And see, this gets back to the original point that I made last hour, that the conservative worldview that rejects the idea that government is us working together for our benefit, that we are about community and family in the United States, that conservative worldview that says that the only purpose for government, you know, outside of the protective purpose, the police purpose, is to enrich those who can use it that way, is exactly what these guys are doing. I mean, and it needs to be called for what it is. And it's a disaster, frankly.
Yeah, they even have a quote here from the Heritage Foundation who says that the employees should be hired for loyalty, not for expertise and competence. And we don't need to look any farther than Katrina for that. And as you've said many times, the Katrina debacle was a way to show that government's no good, even though they wrecked the agency that they sent down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's their strategy, is wreck the government and say, hey, look, it's wrecked. It doesn't work. Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. Gary in New York City. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? I was calling to see if you had read any of the speech that Hillary Clinton had given to AIPAC, the American-Israeli
Political Action Committee.
It's actually Public Affairs Committee. Because they, you know, they want to keep political out of the name, I'm sure.
Sure.
But that's what it is. If you read that without knowing who she is, you would swear this was written by, you know, Bush or one of these neo-creeps. And I was just wondering if you had read it and what your thoughts were on it.
I haven't read it in its entire context. I've had pieces of it sent to me by folks who, like yourself, are concerned about what was said. I really should go back, though, and read the entire thing in context before I comment on it.
Yeah, it might be something you want to look at because, you know, some people are trying to sell her as some type of savior, and she is just another member of the power structure you keep talking about. I mean, she tries to sugarcoat it a bit, you know, but, you know, and maybe she has some good ideas, but...
Well, you know, and way back before Bill was president, she was on the board of directors of Walmart, and. Yes, all that is true. And at the same time, she's also a politician. And in the United States, and Gary, I'm gonna thank you for the call. I'm going to drop the call because the echo is making me crazy. And at the same time, in my opinion, it is all about the parade. It's really ultimately about you and me. It's not about Hillary Clinton. And that's why I've said, you know, I sat here with Terry McAuliffe a week ago, and I said, if Hillary Clinton ends up the nominee of the Democratic Party, I'll work to get her elected. You know, whatever the Democratic Party decides on. Because I believe that if we can get enough people active, if we can get enough people energized, and that's the key to it. I mean, let us stop this salvationist thinking, this belief that if we just get the right politician, and the perfect politician, of course, got to be right on all the issues, then everything will be fine. I'm sorry, there is no right politician. Even Dennis Kucinich isn't the perfect politician, as much as, you know, Dennis is a friend of mine, and I'm right there with him on most of his issues. But the point is, there's no such thing as a perfect politician. And even if there was, that's the wrong kind of thinking. That's not how this country is organized. We are a representative, constitutionally limited democracy, and democratic republic, if you want to be totally politically correct. And what that means is that it has to be us. It has to be coming from us. It has to be us, we the people who are out there, who are speaking out. That's what Bernie Sanders is ranting about every Friday. This is subtext. Everything he's saying is that it ain't going to happen until you and I get involved, not some politician. And if enough of us are out there raising hell, then even if it's Hillary as president, she will change course because, hey, that's what politicians do. They're good politicians, listen to the people. Unfortunately, George W. Bush is not a good politician. He's not listening to us. But I really think that he's an aberration. I think he's the first president that we've ever had who was this bad and probably the worst that we, hopefully, the worst we will ever have. But here's, you know, Russ Feingold talking about this very issue.
This requires public pressure.
Public pressure.
People to let their elected officials know that not only do they want a debate,
so
but
get
they want
active.
Action.
See, that's this is, you know, Russ Feingold talking about it, Bernie Sanders talking. You get it that the true progressives out there are saying we the people need to get engaged and active, and at that level, outside of aberrations like George W. Bush completely ignoring the will of the people and of Congress and everything else. But outside of the occasional aberration, at that level, it is about we the people. And if we the people get sufficiently active and get sufficiently organized and get out there, it doesn't matter who the president is. Ultimately, Franklin Roosevelt was not elected on a New Deal platform. He came up with that phrase at the last minute. It was a throwaway line, the New Deal. But once he got elected, he got it, what the people wanted. And he said, okay, we're going to do it. And the same thing with his cousin Teddy Roosevelt. 45 minutes after the hour. From the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. We will continue our conversation about Hillary and about politicians broadly right across the board and also the green zoning of America. I just read Paul Krugman's column that our caller recommended. It was in yesterday's paper. And he's referring in that to the article that I was referring to in the weekend, in the Saturday or Sunday New York Times, about the contractor that was being paid $104 per person hour to investigate fraud and waste. Whoa! Anyhow, Victoria Jones is with us at the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. right now. We're talking talkradionews.com is the website. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
It is talkradionews.com, isn't it?
It is talkradionews.com,
yes,
that's right.
I've been saying it for, all of a sudden it didn't sound right. What's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I just came from the White House press briefing. I asked a question that I thought might get an answer, which was that the president's been speaking about bipartisanship over the weekend, and yet in the budget there is, with regard to Medicare and Medicaid, $77 billion cut over the next 5 years and $280 billion cut over the next 10 years. And isn't this really rather a slap in the face of Democrats?
Mm-hmm.
And
Tony Snow said?
Well, that it wasn't.
Oh, it's not a slap. It's not a slap in their face. It's a shotgun blast in their face.
It's not. And by
this
the
is
way,
a Cheneyism.
It's not a cut.
Oh, it's not a cut. No, it's a slowing of the rate of increase.
That's exactly right. It's a slowing of the rate of increase.
Below the rate of inflation.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's a slowing of the rate of increase, and then he talked a little bit about private accounts.
Yeah.
So I asked him, well, whether the cut, and I continue to use the word cut.
Right.
Was it was intended to phase out Medicare and Medicaid and replace them with private accounts.
And he said?
No, and it's not a cut.
Do you find it fun sparring like that with Tony Snow?
Yes.
Oh, good. I'm glad, because you do it well. It's yeah. So yesterday the Senate refused to carry on. In fact, Harry Reid ended up having to vote against it, so it was a 49-47 vote so that he could bring it up again, apparently. But all the Democrats and two Republicans voted in favor of this non-binding resolution, but essentially Republicans were saying, you're going to have 60 votes. We're going to filibuster this thing. First of all, why wasn't it just openly and nakedly referred to as a filibuster and, that somebody would call? And secondly, where is Harry Reid going to go from here?
Well, technically, it wasn't a filibuster. So, and they're very precise in the Senate about what they call things. So if it wasn't a technical filibuster, they wouldn't call it one. This was yet another arcane way of getting around things.
Mm.
I think where he goes is he licks his wounds for a little bit, and then he finds another way of bringing it back. I don't think he intends to let this go away. Now, procedurally, I don't know how he brings it back. But I have absolutely no doubt that he will. He intends to have a resolution voted on.
Yeah.
I mean, he's put himself on the line on this.
I understand the Iranians are beginning military exercises in the Persian Gulf tomorrow.
Oh, great.
This is from the Iranian news agency. And
that's helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm just curious if there is some sort of provocation in the Middle East or some sort of Gulf of Tonkin thing going down, do you see any way that the Democrats could avoid having to go along with Bush escalating in the face of provocation?
I think it would be very difficult. I think the only thing that they could do would be to call for caution and to call for a thorough investigation before taking any action against Iran. That's the only thing they could do.
Isn't Russ Feingold talked about passing legislation that says that before Bush can react to anything, before basically he can do anything, he has to come to Congress for the money, for authorization. Do you think that that's a legal strategy or a legislative strategy or a political strategy, for that matter, that actually has some cogency, or is that just, you know, like the signing statements? Is that something Bush would just ignore as well?
Well, I hadn't thought about Bush ignoring it. Yes, I think he'd ignore it.
Yeah.
I think because I think he has such a strong belief in his really broad powers as commander-in-chief. I think he believes that he can do anything.
He thinks he's king.
He believes he can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, this is...
Now that war has started, I think, you know, he would see this as an extension of the war that we're currently in.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the Paul Krugman's talking about how 78% of government contract bids are now awarded on a no-bid basis. It was about half in 2001. It was below that, you know, obviously when Clinton was president, actually believed in civil service. Anybody looking into this stuff? The privatization of America, of our government functions?
If anybody is, I would think it would be Henry Waxman. And he's got his plate full looking at corruption and chicanery and crookery in Iraq.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know whether even he is up to it.
Okay. And finally, there was this news story today, I think this is out of the New York Times, a line item buried in the president's budget reveals the Bush administration is gearing up for emboldened legal challenges from Gitmo detainees. A brief paragraph from President Bush's 2008 budget request shows he plans to hire nearly two dozen new Justice Department lawyers to fight suits brought by Guantanamo detainees challenging their imprisonment. Are we going to see a serious attempt by Congress to bring back habeas corpus?
Oh, I think we are. Oh, most definitely I think we are, yes.
Yeah. Something that dates back to 1215. I mean, this is incredible.
Oh, I think there will be.
Yeah, okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria, for
being
with us today. Good talking with you. Up next, Michael Petty. Or maybe it's Pettit. I'm not sure. EveryChildMatters.org. Red state children, are they at greater risk than blue state children? Does it make a difference where you grow up in the United States? Should it? And how does that fit into the whole political superstructure, substructure, infrastructure of America and what's going on in this country? 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Well, actually, you know, we'd settle for a clean election. We really, that's enough. It would be a good start because then you'd have the will of the people. Michael Pettit Petty is with us. EveryChildMatters.org is website. The author of a new book, the Every Child Matters Education Fund has published a new book called Homeland Insecurity. It can be downloaded for free at their website, EveryChildMatters.org. Hey, Michael, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. You suggest that kids growing up in red states are at greater risk than kids growing up in blue states?
Right.
How so?
Well, it turns...
Other than that their parents are politically crazy.
Well, using official government statistics, you can see which states have the highest rates of infant mortality, premature death rates among children, poverty rates, and so forth. And as it turns out, the states with the best outcomes. 9 of the 10 top states with the best outcomes for children are blue states, and all 10 of the bottom 10 states are red states. And really what it's about is not making investments in the health and social programs that we know benefit children.
Yeah. Now, I'm assuming that you're assuming that there's a causal relationship here, that the politics of the red states that say government should be small and limited and shouldn't be involving itself in people's lives, that political atmosphere, that political perspective is causing there to be a lack of services for kids, and therefore you have an increase in poverty and worse outcomes for kids.
That's right. What you have is an anti-tax, anti-government ideology that's been dominant in much of the country for the last 30 years, and those states tend to tax themselves at much lower levels than other states. And there's a price for that, and you can see it in the outcomes of their child well-being.
Now, what about the folks who would say, well, wait a minute, some of the blue states are also the wealthier states, Massachusetts, New York, California. Wealthier folks are more likely to be providing good health care to their kids, providing good education to their kids. They're more involved in their communities. They're more involved in their kids' lives than poor people are, not necessarily because poor people are bad and not care about their kids, but many times they're working 2 and 3 jobs,
sure,
you know, whatnot. What about that? You know, variable in there. It may have nothing to do with politics.
Well,
it's just a coincidence of geography.
Actually, I would argue that it has everything to do with politics. I think that poverty is, and whether people live in it, is a direct result of some of the policies that government has adopted. And in the top 10 states, you see that they tax themselves at a 17% higher level than in the bottom 10 states. And so one of the reasons why there is more poverty is there hasn't been the same investment in human capital. So when you have my state of Maine, the prison imprisonment rate in Louisiana is 6 times greater than the state of Maine's. If you have 6 times as many people in prison, you're in an unproductive situation that is not really developing human beings at all. As a matter of fact, in Maine, which ranks 4th in overall ranking, it's 35th in per capita income. So it's one of the lower states, and yet it produces much higher outcomes.
So all of this, I guess, leads us to Thomas Frank's eternal question, you know, what's the matter with Kansas? Why? This used to always mystify me at a certain level. When we lived in Vermont, we drive around rural Vermont, and you drive by people who were obviously hanging on by their teeth. You know, their mobile homes were falling apart, and out in front there's a Bush-Cheney sign.
Mm-hmm.
Why the appeal? You know, how does this kind of political and economic ideology continue to sell in these states?
Well, I think it's really easier to be against something than for something. It's easier to say it's your government, it's your money, and you should be able to spend it the way you want, than it is to say we all do better when everybody is lifted and everybody is given equal opportunities. And the fact of the matter is, many of these kids have mistakenly chosen the wrong parents. You know, they are born to parents who are in prison or substance abusers or whatever it happens to be, and they don't do very well, and those kids need a boost. And so I think, you know, we deal with a lot of simple slogans, I think that doesn't serve us very well. And you need to be more informed about what it means to invest. And, you know, against the other rich democracies, all the other rich democracies have much better outcomes for their children than we do, whether it's in the area of health care or child abuse or whatever it happens to be. And the differences are large in the United States. They're not small. They're large. For example, in the bottom 10 states, kids are twice as likely to die before the age of 14 than in the top 10 states. And so the numbers are really big numbers. Children in the bottom states are 7 times more likely to die from child abuse than kids in the top states. So these are big numbers, and they don't lend themselves to simple solutions.
We're talking with Michael.
Slogan.
Yeah, simple slogans. Is it Michael Petit?
Yes, Michael Petit.
Michael Petit with EveryChildMatters.org. Their new study, Homeland Insecurity, a new book that they've published, is downloadable for free at their website, EveryChildMatters.org. And is there a correlation with vast wealth, the reciprocal of that? Do you find that in those states, I think one of the assumptions that the conservatives make is that if they can get government out of the way and if they can get rid of social programs and whatnot, that it will be possible to amass great fortunes, and that that's a desirable thing, that they somehow measure the quality of a nation by its most powerful institutions. You know, we're the home of Bill Gates. And do you find, obviously, in Arkansas, you've got, you know, the Walton family, although I don't know if all of Sam Walton's heirs still live in Arkansas. But do you find that there's, that in those states that have the greatest poverty, that there's also extremes of wealth? Or, you know, on the other hand, again, New York and Massachusetts, you think there's a lot of very wealthy people there.
Well, let's take a look at what is maybe the crucible of compassionate conservatism, the epicenter of it. A classic low-tax, low-investment state is Texas.
Sure.
Texas has great wealth. But Texas also has some of the worst outcomes. For example, the highest percentage of uninsured kids in the nation is in Texas. It has the fourth worst rate of immunizing two-year-olds. It has a birth rate 50% higher than the national average. It has the highest number of child abuse deaths. It has the highest percentage of households experiencing food insecurity. It has the highest number of adults who are incarcerated and the sixth highest crime rate. So, yeah, you got more millionaires in Texas than in some places.
And billionaires.
And billionaires. But you have widespread suffering in much of the population. You know, so here, for example, on the healthcare side, you've got large numbers of people that think that, hey, let's invest in medical care and health insurance. It's a good way to make money. In other countries, the attitude is, hey, everybody ought to have a floor below which they don't fall when it comes to healthcare. So they do it for much less, serve more people, and have better outcomes than we do.
Well, and that's the magic word is invest. Prior to Reagan coming along and starting his campaign to basically destroy government, to convince us that government is a bad thing. I mean, you know, Reagan even making the comment once that there are no good minds in government. If they were, they would have been hired by private industry. Reagan, who said...
I've always felt the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And we, prior to the Reagan era, we understood about investment. We understood that money spent on a school, you know, $1,000 spent on a school is going to be $100,000 in taxes over the next 50 years coming back from the children who go through that school. That $1 million put into building a road was going to be $100 million in commerce over the 20 or 30 year lifespan of that road. We understood that investment in infrastructure, investment in our people, that, you know, the GI Bill, the investment in our young men and women going to college, that these were investments, not expenses. And yet since Reagan, we have viewed the cost of government in so many ways as an expense rather than an investment. How do we change the dynamic in America? How do we wake people up to the fact that there is a difference between an expense and an investment, and that one of the things that government can and should do is actually invest in its people?
Well, you know, back in 1900, we had more than 100, the infant mortality rate was 100 per 1,000 live births. That is, 100 babies out of 1,000 born didn't make it. Today, in the state of Maine, it's 3 per 1,000. Nationally, it's 7 or 8 per 1,000. We've had a 99% reduction in the number of maternal deaths at birth since 1900. That is all principally due to major investments by the federal government in public health and research and so forth. And now, you know, you've got these people with some of these anti-tax groups like this Grover Norquist guy, you know,
sure.
He likes to talk about, wanting to drag the...
drown it in the bathtub.
Yeah, drown the baby in the bathtub. And, you know, I wonder, you know, which of program would he really want to drown? The Supplemental Security Income Program that serves 5 million kids who have parents...
Oh, sure, he'd do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, who have died or become disabled.
Yeah, and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah,
and you know, I've debated this with Grover Norquist on this program. Yes,
yeah.
He would do away with all of those programs, I'll tell you. Michael Pettit, everychildmatters.org is the website. A great new study summary book that you can download, called Homeland Insecurity. Michael, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
When you pack the sky, scrapers fill the air. But will you keep on building higher till there's no more room up there? Will you make us laugh? Will you make us cry? Will you tell us when to live? Will you tell us when to die?
We're changing day to day. Tell me, why do the children play?
And welcome back to the radio support group of by and for We the People of the United States of America. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman program. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some, and then he'll have another problem with customs. And you know how it goes. Anyhow, let me put this in a larger context, this discussion that we just had with Michael Pettit, there, Petit. His point was that without a basic floor, without some sort of a foundation, without an investment, without a society, without this notion that we're all in this together, this idea that the liberal democracies of the world all play out, this idea that came out of the Enlightenment, out of the 1600s, out of John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, this idea that frankly humans have shared since the dawning of human history, that Aboriginal and Indigenous people all over the world understand, called tribe and clan and community, this idea that we are here for each other, this idea that the religious leaders of the world have always talked about, pick your religion, that without a basic foundation underneath us, that we cannot have not only a functional society, not only a safe place to live. And I've worked in third world countries where literally you walk out the front door and there's a bunch of kids standing there with their hands out and they're covered with scabs and sores and sick and, you know, TB everywhere and everything else. But even beyond that, you can't have, and this is the most important part, you can't have democracy. Without a functional middle class, you can't have a democracy. This is what the founders and framers got. It's just such a core concept, and it's one that was completely missed by the cons and the neocons when they went charging into Iraq, which had been decimated by 9 years of sanctions. The middle class in Iraq was already starting to fall apart. We now have over 2 million refugees from Iraq, and what are they? They're mostly the middle class. And what you have left behind is the working poor and the middle class that has now become the working poor. What, 50, 60% unemployment? You can't have a democracy without a middle class. Every time any country, whether it's a military coup from within or whether it's somebody like us coming from without, every time we come in and say, okay, we're going to turn you into a democracy, if there's not a middle class, it doesn't work. And to the extent that the middle class in the United States is being destroyed, democracy is going with it. Bret Stephens in today's Wall Street Journal. This is a conservative columnist writing a conservative column that is basically pitching, oh, you know, everything's fine, we'll work all this out. But he makes a really interesting point. He opens this column in today's Wall Street Journal. He says, in September 2004, Mithal al-Alusi, then a director general in Iraq's De-Ba'athification Commission, attended a counterterrorism conference in Israel. Upon his return to Baghdad, he was stripped of his job and threatened with arrest for violating a Ba'ath-era law forbidding contact with Israel. In February 2005, his two sons, Ayman, 30, and Gamal, 22, were murdered, gunned down in plain view of their father. Credit for the murders was jointly claimed by the Ba'ath Party and Janish Anshar al-Sunnah, an al-Qaeda affiliate. The following December, Mr. Alusi was elected to Parliament as head and sole representative of the Iraqi Nation Party. What does his party stand for? Democracy, liberalism, secularism, anti-terrorism, and national unity. The question for Iraq is, does anyone stand with Mr. Alusi? Now, Bret Stephens, in his column in the Wall Street Journal, doesn't get into the whole issue of the middle class, and he comes to a different conclusion than I am. I'm saying no. It's like, you know, Palestine. You go in there and say the Palestinian territories, oh, yes, you're going to have a democracy, but you can't have a middle class. Well, people who are starving, people who are hungry, people who are without hope, they're not going to elect, you know, liberal, egalitarian, democratic leaders. They're going to elect demigods. Gogs. They're going to elect strongmen. They're going to elect people that they think are going to make them safe. Safety and security first, right? Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. Let's make sure that the roof is not falling in. Let's make sure there aren't bombs falling on us. And then we can talk about whether or not we're going to have a debate about, you know, a political issue. You have to have the middle class first.
And Bremer, when Bremer went in with the Coalition Provisional Authority into Iraq, the first thing they did was what they thought was actually going to create tremendous prosperity. You know, we're going to create year zero. We're going to create a libertarian paradise. Flat tax of 15%, make unions illegal, allow any corporation to come in and do anything. It was the conservative agenda writ large, and they thought that it was going to be so successful that there wasn't even a need for a plan B. Within 6 months, there would be an extraordinary economic paradise. And instead, what happened? 50% unemployment. The predictable outcome, really, if you look at it. 50% unemployment, wiping out buildings, shutting down industries, corporations exploiting people, bringing, you know, cheap labor in from outside the country. We're building a city inside the green zone with no Iraqi labor. And the Iraqis are happy about this? No. 27 minutes past the hour.
Hey, this is the life I couldn't live without. No, I couldn't live without. It's a moment frozen there in time. The reasons all will get around. Love's a little bigger and you finally start figuring out. That's what it's all about.
Talking back to the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, 440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello to some of the finest minds in the entire internet, maybe the entire universe, you never know. Indeed. Brian in Laguna Beach, California. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I wanted to kind of dive into the idea of your recurring theme that as a population we need to be getting more active and getting involved, which I agree is absolutely vital to repairing our democracy here.
Yeah.
I was an architecture major for a year at UC Berkeley, and what I found is actually taught me a very useful way to approach problem solving and strategizing and creating solutions. You know, why are we making this building and what's the best way to construct it so it serves that purpose?
Sure.
I think the Democratic Party does have a chronic weakness in the area of developing and implementing effective strategies. So I think it's worth spending some time on identifying what progressive strategy is. And to a large part, I know your upcoming book, Cracking the Code, is dealing on effectively implementing that strategies. I think it's important we have a clear vision of what we're trying to accomplish. They call them mission statements in the business world,
sure,
but it's important for individuals, I think, as well. There's certainly a recruitment element to it, you know, not only being active yourself, but also encouraging other people to be active, which is, you know, part of what you do on a daily basis. But I think our overall goal in terms of creating a government that truly represents the will of the people, you know, of, by, and for the people is our goal, but that's very intangible. So I think what we need to do is break it down into specifics, which from what I can tell are on the side of there's forming public opinion, which in that element you talk a lot about the importance of maintaining net neutrality and, you know, also I believe,
sure,
kind of undoing what Clinton did in terms of deregulation.
Yeah, undoing Clinton and Reagan's deregulation of
media. Right, and so there's the forming of public opinion side of it, which there's the media reform element, and then there's the second element, which is getting that public opinion expressed in legislation, which I think there's, on that side, there's the election side of it,
yeah,
which, Bernie Sanders talks a lot about the importance of public funding of elections. And also, I think you mentioned the other day, instant runoff voting. I think that's, you know, equally important there as well.
Brian, I'm sorry to hurry you up here, but I've got a whole bunch of other calls, and we just can't go through a laundry list here. Your point.
Well, what I'd like to get is kind of your feedback on the first of all, do you think it's important that we kind of break these down into sub-strategies?
Yes.
And, you know, are these...
Yes, and at the same time, I think that it's really important that people get this bigger picture thing, that there is the bottom line difference in the conservative versus the liberal or progressive worldview, that the conservative worldview is, I'm in it for myself, I got mine, screw you, and the progressive worldview is, we're all in this together, we care about each other, I care about you, you care about me, we're working together as a people to make life better for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And the conservatives like to deride that ladder, and they don't frankly like the harsh characterization that I gave of the former. But if you look at their policies, that's what it boils down to.
It really does.
And I think that what we need to be doing as much as we can, Brian, and thank you very much for the call, is to just nail that, is to identify that over and over and over again in a whole variety of policies, whether it's the privatization of government like Paul Krugman was doing, or whether it's in health care, or in the need for public health care, or whether it's in voting machines, and I mean, just, you know, right across the board, there's a whole bunch of them there. Eric in Modesto, California. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Basically, I'm getting some static, actually, but in regards to a call you had about a week ago talking about recovering Republicans.
Yes, sir.
And I am one of those, and I was kind of going to share my story on how I basically saw the light.
Okay, great.
One of the main things that helped me become more liberal is music, and in particular punk rock music.
Mm-hmm.
And I started listening to a lot of bands that basically brought issues to the forefront, such like bands like Anti-Flag. I don't know if you've heard much of them.
So this was music for you was the door to issues. You were not reading about issues in the paper or listening to politicians. You were listening to musicians talking about them. You know, back in the 60s, there was a lot of that going on as well in the anti-war movement.
Oh, definitely. I actually did a report in high school about the 60s and how music brought it up front. But there's a lot of really good websites like punkvoter.com and the Underground Network that basically just get a lot of ideas out there, and it made me open my eyes and realize my way of thinking was totally backwards.
Well, that's great. Well, welcome to America, Eric. Welcome back.
Thanks a lot. I don't even like to even talk about my days as a Republican or anything like that.
Well, thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing that with us, and good on you for seeing the light. Bonnie in Burgesstown, thank you for the call. Bonnie in Burgesstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, you want to disagree with me about Hillary Clinton?
Yes, in reference to the scenario of her nomination,
yes.
I don't think there's a perfect candidate either, and I, too, believe in the parade, but I do believe we have to sound the clarion bell warning against the Dems' dumb approach to nominating presidential candidates. It's timid and tepid, and they keep coming close to that 50% mark where, you know, who knows if they lose or not, because we don't know about the voting machines. And then they turn around and blame the real Dems, who want a real Democratic contender who's not afraid of its roots and who's courageous and convicted, and we'd like to have an accountable voting system,
well,
too, I might add.
Yeah, as you know, Bonnie, I agree with you. I mean,
I can't work for her.
Well,
I could vote for her, but I just can't work for her. Now, she might benefit from my going around trying to oust our Bush-bought U.S. Representative Timmy Murphy, but, you know, because candidates in the Democratic ticket are kind of packaged together,
but I just can't
work for her.
I understand. And I understand that Hillary doesn't, you know, that her DLC leanings or moderate Democratic or whatever you want to call it, you know, don't reflect your worldview. They don't reflect mine right at the moment, by and large, in many areas. I mean, in some areas I agree with her, in other areas I don't. But here's the thing. If you or I were to participate in the Republican Party right now, we would get nowhere. We would get absolutely nowhere at all. On the other hand, if you and I were to join the Democratic Party, even if Hillary was at the top of the ticket, and start working to bring about change in the directions that we're understanding this country should go, there's a very real possibility that ultimately even Hillary would come around. And so I think that we do ourselves a huge disservice by basically closing the only door we have, because Ralph Nader is not going to be the guy who's the next president of the United States, by closing the only door that we have, which is the Democratic Party. I am not and never have been here to promote the Democratic Party. I'm not even registered as a Democrat. As you know, I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000.
So did I, and I'm not ashamed of that.
There you go. Yeah, neither am I. But the point is that we do have a two-party system in this country. I mean, we're pretty much stuck with it. We don't have proportional representation, and we don't have instant runoff voting. You know, we're one of only basically five or seven countries in the world who are stuck with this system, but we have this first-past-the-post-winner-take-all system that essentially forces a two-party system on us. And so rather than, you know, my saying, oh, I'm all in favor of the Democratic Party, I'm saying something far more radical than that. I'm saying that we must infiltrate the Democratic Party and take it over. And even if Hillary is the presidential candidate, I think that if we're out there working and if we're out there participating, we become the parade that she has to listen to.
Well, I think we probably agree much more than we disagree. I guess I can't say that I will work for her. Maybe I will. Maybe I will.
I'll give you that.
Indirectly. And I can sleep better tonight knowing that I don't disagree with you too much.
Okay.
But don't you think that the Dems make the mistake of starting the campaign in the middle and then ending up to the right of center? And then the cons don't do that. They start at the right of center and stay there.
I know. And there's so much to learn. The Democratic strategists have, you know, I mean, Bob Schrum has lost 8 elections in a row for the Democrats, and they keep going back to these guys. Bonnie, I share your frustration.
Okay.
And again, I think that it's not going to change until folks like you and I get involved. We need to get involved. We need to get active and out there participating. Bonnie, thanks so much for the call. John, and flipping from the West Coast, the East Coast back to the West Coast, John in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'm listening, and I'm hearing what you're saying as far as infiltrating the Democratic Party, but I've gotten to a place where I think I'm more radical than that, because I see in these people, when you talk about the fact that they stole the first election, possibly stole the second election, they lied to us and got us into war, I think it's time for a new declaration of independence, in my opinion. And the fact is, what we've got here, and they basically admitted through the unitary, through their belief in the unitary executive, that we have a new king.
Sure, but the they you're talking about is not the Democratic Party. It's the Bush administration.
I totally agree with what you're saying, Tom, but what I'm telling you is it's time for people, as in general, to declare that this situation has gotten out of hand.
Yeah.
They have subverted,
you know,
the Constitution.
John, we talked about this on this program last week, I think, about how back in 1773, these committees of correspondence formed. People started forming, you know, meetings in their homes all over what is now the United States, the colonists. They basically said the British government isn't working. We're going to create our own. And they created essentially a shadow government. And I see that happening. I see that happening on the web. I see that happening at MoveOn.org.
Absolutely.
I see that happening over at Daily Kos. I see that happening at BuzzFlash. I see that happening all over the place, that committees of correspondence are organizing. And I think that we are on the verge of taking this country back. And I think incrementally we are, John. And we have to take a break here, but I appreciate the call. Step by step, we have to do this. And it's not all going to come at once. And it's not going to be, hey, tomorrow, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's president and instantly everything works fine. But we're moving in the right direction. I really believe we are. 45 minutes past the hour.
People go through life never knowing what love is or where it's going. Me and you, girl, we just walked up on his feet.
Welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman here with you, coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Diana in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. Hey, Diana, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. I love you. I love Bernie Sanders, too.
Thank you. Isn't Bernie great?
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to talk to you about is, I'm a Southern girl, married a Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
My husband took his high school. Then Canada, back in the 60s, when he went to school, paid him $20 a week, gave him free books, free tuition at a trade school. He went there for a year, took his test, passed. He took his ticket and became fourth-year apprentice under a master. In the wintertime, he went back for 6 more weeks of school, and Canadian government paid him. After 5 years, he wrote his master ticket.
Yeah. In other words,
everywhere, Tom. We've been to the Northwest Territories. We've been to Labrador. We've been to the Azores. We've been offered jobs in Nigeria. The minute they find out he is a Canadian tradesperson, everybody wants him.
Yeah, it's the same thing when I lived in Germany. It's the exact same thing. If you get the certification of both the government and the unions in Germany indicating that you've actually done your apprenticeship, It means that there has been an investment in you, and that knowledge base has value. Excellent points, Diane. I guess the bottom line is,
and he's always paid taxes, no matter where he is.
Yeah. The bottom line here is that those countries that invest in education get that investment back in return. It's well said, Diana. Thank you very much. In fact, when I was in Russia, we started a program. We were building some houses. I read about this in one of my books, and we had hired a Russian construction crew, and there was a bunch of Germans who were working with us, and the Germans were literally professional, journeyman masons, and the Russians were guys who had never laid bricks before. And I remember walking into this house that was half built, and with these two German guys, and there's three Russian guys working there. And this was back, right after, about a year after the Soviet Union fell, and Russia was kind of the Wild West at the time. This was in the Kaliningrad area. And you could see between the bricks into the chimney. You could see daylight through the bricks because the mortar was so poorly done. And the Germans are just going nuts. How can you do this so bad? And the Russians are like, hey, what's the big deal? We'll just plug the holes. And, having a conversation with the Germans is like, for them to get to the point where they were journeyman bricklayers took 4 or 5 years of education and training and working an apprenticeship. And like you said, Diana, they could go anywhere in the world and get a job doing that. And that's the investment in the infrastructure of a nation. Judy in Dana Point, California. Hey, Judy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Getting back to the gentleman you had before the break, between the red states and the blue states,
mm-hmm.
It always amazes me that in the red states and the Bible Belt that they want to prevent stem cell research and have no abortions, and they're very against that, but they have no social programs to help these children once they're in the world.
Yeah,
absolutely none.
Yeah, it's a culture of life that seems to stop at birth. It's a very, very bizarre conundrum, Judy. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't understand it. It's beyond me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. It needs to be pointed out more often. Scott in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Tom. Want to run a couple of things past you real quick. First of all, you're the best thing to hit radio since the Kilohertz.
thank you.
Which is saying something. I forget the guy's name, but he was making a statement earlier. Basically, what he was saying was, as far as involvement, you can eat an elephant, but you've got to do it one bite at a time, and it requires, and the elephant is rather apt,
sure.
But it requires us to all dig in, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah, and that takes us back to, Russ Feingold's comment. Let me just play just 5 seconds of this.
This requires public pressure. It requires people to let their elected officials know that not only do they want a debate, but they want action.
In other words, get out there and get involved. Don't just vote. Make the phone calls, write the letters, write the letters to the editor, call into talk radio, get involved.
And the other thing is, as far as Bremer's plan, to bring the drowned the baby of government in the bathtub to Iraq.
In Iraq, yeah.
That has screwed up things here and hasn't worked. How, and with all we've got going for us in this country, how the hell could we expect it to even come close to succeeding in any positive way over there in Iraq?
Oh, I know. It's an absolute disaster, and it points out the essential foundation, Scott, and thank you for the call, of how it doesn't work and how they have to essentially use deceit to make it work. Here's Paul Weyrich, the conservative strategist who claims that he brought Reagan to power and is still working in the Republican Party.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And that's before a group of Republicans in a church, thus the Christian reference in the beginning. Paul Weyrich, the godfather of Republican direct marketing and of Republican voter suppression efforts. This is the reason why they're running the negative campaigns, to stop people from showing up. Coming up on tomorrow's program, the top news of the day, plus conservative Michael Payne and I debate Bush versus the anti-war movement. Greg Palast will be here. He just interviewed Hugo Chavez. That should be fascinating. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, the Democracy Zone. And don't forget, my friends, never forget, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.